Thank you all for masking in order to look out for each other. This morning, I'd like to talk about the Four Noble Truths, which is the Buddha's most basic teaching. I'm in the process of teaching an introductory class on the Four Noble Truths that meets on Wednesday nights. We've had one class so far. And in that class, I told the story of the Buddha's life to talk about what got him to the point where he was ready to set forth this doctrine of the Four Noble Truths. And we also began to examine dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering. And we're going to move on to desire and the cessation of desire and the Eightfold Path, which is a method for achieving this. And I'd like to thank the student that I talked to this week in Dokusan for engaging me in a very sincere conversation. Surprising how a short encounter can expand into an entire Dharma talk. So this morning, I'd like to explore the Four Noble Truths by talking about an extended example of how to deal with desire and the cessation of desire during challenging times. And this won't really repeat anything from the class, except, of course, the basics of what the Four Noble Truths are all about. It's kind of a supplement to the class for those who are in it, and also something that I can share with everyone. So I'm going to talk about some of my experiences for the past few weeks. As you know, if you've heard some of my talks, I like to talk about my personal experiences sometimes. Not all Dharma teachers do that as much, and that's fine because there are many different ways to teach. But I'm kind of compelled to talk about what is most alive for me, and I think that tends to help me to share the Dharma, to kind of share how you do this stuff, which is my primary interest. So it helps me to be more compelling, I think. And also, it's just an ongoing story I like to kind of share about reopening the center, which is something I talked about in my last couple of Dharma talks. If you'll forgive me for kind of ranking things, I have to say that this past month or so has been one of the most wonderful, joyful, and intense and challenging times in my entire life. And I've been very much energized by it. During this time, we finished up the construction here and we prepared for reopening. We had our reopening weekend, which was only 2 weeks ago. And now we're dealing with setting up new systems. And I'm in contact with so many people. I get to talk to and work with so many people. It's just wonderful. And I'm really grateful that I'm in this position where I'm able to have this kind of a deep, extended challenge, which has been so vivid for me and so engaging. And it's really deepening my practice. As I've said before, it's like being on a sesshin, a formal retreat, except it's all work period, and it goes on and on and on. But I feel alive, and it's great. And sometimes it's hard. And this morning, I'd like to talk about how desire and cessation of desire work when things get hard. To do that, I have to talk a little bit about the difficulty of the past month, just a little bit. And I hesitated to even talk about this because it would be really easy to continue to talk about the pure joy and ecstasy of reopening, and that would be fun. And I could go on and on about that. But we tend not to dwell so much on stuff that's already happened here. We tend to move on to the next thing. But if I did that, if I did only that, if I only talked about sort of the joy of it, I think it might wear a bit thin after a while. We might all get the feeling that something was being left out. Because any situation of joy and adventure and even ecstasy, sort of a dramatic presence with things as they are, is going to have an undercurrent of something else. And to be complete, we have to explore that as well. And also being complete may help me to undermine some naive ideas that some of us tend to harbor about what it's like to be a long-term practitioner like me and have a deepening practice. Because it's easy to have an idea, and I used to have this myself, that if one can just deepen one's practice enough, life will be pure, unmitigated joy all of the time. And there will be complete freedom, and all negativity will drop away. And I'm afraid that's not quite the case. The truly deepened practice has to do with being present. It doesn't mean everything will be ecstatic all the time. It means that one will be present unflinchingly all of the time, or most of it anyway, or much of it anyway. It means that one will continue to show up, be present with what's there, whether it's pleasant or not, and will not add to the suffering by trying to avoid or deny what's unpleasant. So you don't eliminate suffering, but you can learn how to add to the suffering. I mean, we can look at the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva deliberately renounces entry into nirvana in order to stay here in this world and help all beings, to help those who are suffering the most. And is the Bodhisattva having a good time all of the time in doing that? I doubt it. I think they voluntarily agree to share the pain. They voluntarily enter into the great difficulty of day-to-day life with those who are suffering. I think of the Catholic worker movement, which I've long admired, and I've known many people who have been involved in that movement. Peter Morin and Dorothy Day deliberately gave up their own comforts to establish houses of hospitality for the poor, while also looking deeply into systemic problems that caused poverty. And they shared the pain, and they saw what it was like. And it was not necessarily joyful. And I think it was really hard most of the time. But if you could see it from the inside, I think, from their point of view, I think you would see that their need for personal joy kind of dropped away, because it wasn't about them individually. There was a deeper collective joy that they connected with. So, yeah, we don't have to have unrealistic views about what a deepening practice can give us. Yes, there is a great freedom to it, but it's not the kind of freedom that we envision with our needy mind. It's about leaving that needy mind behind. We can't really imagine it until we're in it. It's like a fish trying to imagine walking on land. I was also a little hesitant to talk about the challenges of reopening because I thought, oh no, people will think I'm not enjoying my job. But I can assure you that's not the case. I love doing this. I love organizing work crews. I love working with people in person. And we've had so many joyful moments doing this, and so many nice moments, quiet moments, satisfying moments. I love being here during the day because I've started to spend a lot of time here again. And people drop in and we talk. I've always got time to talk to people. And I get to have one-on-one meetings with people. And I write talks and I attend sittings and services. And when my brain gets a little too full, I wander downstairs and I pull some weeds or I water the new grass out back. But I'm not going to be unrealistic and say it's never hard. Of course it's hard. Difficulty is part of everyone's life, and you cannot escape it. So how do the Four Noble Truths apply when things get difficult? Well, just for a little bit of review, the Buddha's very first teaching, after his enlightenment, after he spent some time kind of settling, and after he found his five ascetic friends and reconnected with them, his first sermon, his first sutra, was about the Four Noble Truths. And it is the foundation of his teaching, which is eminently practical. He was motivated to undertake his spiritual search by the problem of suffering and the hope of ending suffering. That's what his teaching is all about. The first noble truth is that there is dukkha. And this is usually translated as suffering, but it's deeper than that. It encompasses ordinary physical and mental suffering, but it also encompasses the pain we feel as a result of the fact that everything changes. We try to hang on to what's good, even as it's slipping away, and that gives us an unrealistic view of the world, because we're viewing the world through the lens of our own desire to hold on to things, rather than viewing the world as it actually is. And dukkha also encompasses a kind of existential angst, not really knowing who we are and why we're here and what we're supposed to do and why we feel this separateness from other things. The second noble truth is that suffering is caused by desire. Our desire to have things stay the same when they're good and to be different when they're bad. Our inability to accept things as they are. Our constant fight to change things that can't be changed, which is going against the flow of the universe. The third noble truth is that we can end our suffering by ending our desire. We can go with the universe instead of going against it. We can accept that things change and stop wasting our energy fighting against things that we can't change. And the fourth noble truth is that there is an eightfold path for doing this. We pay close attention to understanding, thought, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And these four truths apply to just about anything we do. It is remarkable how this doctrine, which was enunciated 2,500 years ago, can still work to make us understand human behavior, our own behavior, so much of the time. Another way to talk about desire is to talk about clinging. We cling to things that are good, we cling to our fixed ideas, and there is the opposite of clinging, aversion. We try to push away the thing that we don't like. So I've had plenty of opportunities to apply the Four Noble Truths in the recent past. As you know, if you've been around at all, we've reopened after 16 months of closure. The closure was due to COVID, but it also coincided with our construction project. We're in a new zendo and we're back. And it feels like there have been several phases to this. There was the initial planning phase, which went on forever. And then there was the decision-making about the construction and raising the money. And then there was the closure of the center, which was just really rapid in response to COVID, and the rapid setting up of new systems on Zoom. And then there were 16 months of exclusive Zoom practice. And there was a time when the building sat empty, and then the construction phase. And the construction workers left the building for the most part on July 28th, which was only 25 days ago. And that started the new phase of intense work, which many of you know about, a lot of you know about, I can see as I look around, because you were here. You were dusting, removing massive amounts of dust. You were shop vacuuming, sweeping, spreading mulch outside, and just a little bit of everything. And that built up to our reopening celebration, which was just 14 days ago. And if you were here, I think you saw that it was a really joyful day. I was in my office greeting people who came up to take a look at what was going on up there. And afterwards, we had tea in the backyard. And it was just, I thought, it was just one of the great days of my life, because so much had gone into working toward that day. And it was such a joyful thing. And this Sangha means so much to me. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And right after that, we started, so 2 weeks ago, we started settling into a new phase. And this was a phase I really hadn't anticipated or thought about very much. I think I had kind of a naive idea that we would have our reopening and then everything would be back to normal and we would just settle into things the way it used to be. And I could see my Eno was laughing here because he may have anticipated it more than I did. But it slowly dawned on me that that's not the case because there's so much left to be done. You know, there's still a lot of physical work. There are still things to set up. We have to set up the changing room and the activity room. And we still have things stacked up here and there that we have to find places with, places for. We have to restore the grounds outside. That's going to take probably a few years. And we have to set up new systems. How do you move around in this new Zendo? How do you train all the domons? What kind of work needs to get done in that 10-minute period after morning meditation when we have a little work? When can we get all of the altars up? And how do we fill all of these positions? You know, we have a lot of volunteer positions here at Zen Center. We have our Who Does What chart, which is a long sheet with very small print. There are a lot of names on there. And some people have moved on during this period. And we have a lot of willing volunteers, a lot of new folks moving into volunteer jobs, which is just wonderful. But we need to train them. And sometimes there's a little lag time on that. And we do have a bit of a shortage of people because, for one thing, a lot of people are not comfortable with coming back to be present here physically with other people yet because of COVID, which I totally respect and totally understand, and I'm glad they're taking care of themselves in that way. And I'm glad that we still have Zoom so we can still connect. But we have a number of open positions, things like Tuesday greeter and Sunday attendant. That's the person who brings in the podium and does a few other things. And so those are open. So by the way, if you would like to take something on, please talk to me or talk to our Eno, Jeremy, about that. And then there has been setting up the new Zoom systems, which is really a bit of a challenge because we want to have hybrid programming, or in some cases, parallel programming. And because we need to include everyone. And I'd really like to commend our tech team, especially Paul and Bernie, who have been just great and have put in this massive effort and hours and hours and hours that they've spent here. Running wires here and there and figuring out things that I don't understand at all. And they've done a truly remarkable job. But it's a complex process. And as I've said before, I hope everyone on Zoom will kind of be patient with us as we work the bugs out. And Zoom experience is going to, I think, steadily improve. And as I said before, it was paramount that we get back together practicing in person rather than trying to perfect everything and waiting to invite everyone in. So, yeah, we're in this new phase here. And I still love my job, but now and then I'm like, wow, that particular problem is still here. And it's been a long day, and I'm not sure I'm up for that right now, which is fine, because unless there's an extreme deadline here, I can relax, I can leave it for the next day, I can come downstairs, I can sweep the front walk. I don't need to be relentlessly driven about this stuff. So how do the Four Noble Truths fit in? Well, I do think that I've learned something over the years about this. Some of this is just the benefit of getting older and getting it wrong so many times, that eventually you wake up and you say, you know, I could try something different this time and maybe not get it wrong this time. And some of it, most of it, I think, is the benefit of practice, the benefit of trying to live these basic teachings. And I think what I've learned is to not get too excited about how it's going. It's true, you know, on the one hand, that I reached this kind of ecstatic state, putting in these long hours at everything, and just keeping at it with this kind of extraordinary momentum and energy. But I think my attitude toward it was crucial as well. Don't make too big a deal out of it. I think when I was younger and I got it wrong so much of the time, I would have said to myself, finally, it's happened. I've become the person I've always wanted to be, and it's going to be like this from now on. And I will do anything to preserve it. It's going to be like this. It's got to be like this from here on out. I tended to do that, and everything's got good. But I took that approach a lot of times. I got burned a lot of times. And I just know now that that approach would be a big waste of energy, because I know this is not going to last forever. The energy will fade. And in fact, it's fading a little bit now. And it'll become kind of a grind. And it's already doing that to some extent. And it's not surprising. It's just fatigue, that's all. But we see this kind of thing a lot in older people. They've got this steady thing going because they've seen it all. That's one reason elders are so valued. They see the long-term picture, and they know that things go up and down, and they know that there's a steadiness behind it all. So I accept this fall from grace. Here I go. It's okay. I'll be present during the fall. It doesn't have to be great all the time. And I know from long experience, if I truly accept the fall, it will turn into an ascent again. That always happens. At least that's the view from kind of a self-centered point of view. If you accept the fall, it turns into ascent. The non-self-centered way of looking at it is that there really is no fall and no ascent. It's just being. I'm ready for it, whatever comes up, because I'm not too excited about whether it continues to be good or whether it turns bad or anything. I'm just there. I'm just there with it, steadily. So I say, don't try so hard to hang on to the good stuff. Don't try so hard to push away the bad stuff. And it's not so much a matter of bad or good. Just let it all in. I can set aside an intractable problem for a while. I can go outside and enjoy the yard. I can talk to a neighbor. I can hang out with people who drop in during the day. I can hear the chipping of the cardinals and the chipmunks during morning meditation. I can pay attention to all that. So that's the basic practice of the Four Noble Truths. You see how your suffering is grounded in desire. The desire to have the good things continue to be good. Our desire for the universe to conform to our needs. We can let go of that desire. We can see the universe as it is, not as we want it to be. We can stop clinging, and that's the practice. And you can free up so much energy if you stop with me. One thing that helps me now, when we're in this new phase of setting up systems, and as we're realizing that we did this extraordinary thing of upending everything through construction during a pandemic, and that it's going to be kind of a slow grind to finish setting it all up, one thing that helps me is to accept the grindingness of it. It is a bit of a grind. That's okay. We know about the grind. We're familiar with that. And this is where Zen practice coincides, I think, with our attitude toward work. Or I should say my attitude. I shouldn't speak for others. And I'm from an earlier generation than many of you. And I know attitudes about work are changing. But I think about my own attitudes toward work and how they help me, and that maybe they have a bit of a dark side to pay attention to as well. And I've talked in recent weeks about work in the sense of being present with it, just being here doing the work, which we might call right mindfulness. But today I'm thinking more of the persistence of work, keeping at it over time, which is something we might classify as right effort. And I was a bit of a latecomer to the principle that steady, persistent work is a good thing. I spent a lot of time in my 20s avoiding steady work because I thought I had bigger fish to fry. And it was a big wide world and I wanted to get to know it on my terms. And so I would earn some money sometimes and then I would save it up and I would take some time off and I would live cheap. But I had a few forays into steady work early on. When I was maybe, I think about 20, I spent 3.5 months at a factory bending sheet metal, running a brake press on the graveyard shift, working with my dad and my brother. And it was really good. And you punched a time clock in those days. And I bet a lot of people here have never punched a time clock. But that's what you did. And there was a certain satisfaction in seeing your time card at the end of the week with everything filled in. And later, I spent a lot of time building grain elevators, traveling around, pouring cement. And it could be really intense work. It could be 12-hour shifts. It could be a 72-hour week. But then you'd get some time off if you wanted. And you could take a week off or a month or sometimes a whole winter. Then there were a couple of years at a packing plant cutting meat. It was a good union job, United Food and Commercial Workers, and it was more money than I had ever dreamed of. I got up to $9.26 an hour in 1982, and I got a nice truck and everything. And again, there was a time clock, and we usually had to work more than 40 hours, which meant time and a half, which was really great. And so most weeks I would have a full-time card, and usually it was 44 or 46 hours. And there was this sense that you just keep on grinding away. You know, it was hard work, really unpleasant work, and kind of dangerous work. But you just keep grinding away. No matter what happens, you just keep showing up for work. And everything else is subservient to that. You do what you have to do, but you fill in that time clock. And that's good because it's right effort. But it kind of has a dark side too, because you can end up justifying just about anything if it enables you to get through work. And after the packing plant, I went without a job again for some time while I was concentrating on political activism. And then finally, at the age of 30, I became a father and I began a period of continuous full-time work or sometimes school, which has lasted through now. And I'm really grateful for that. And I know not everyone is able to manage that because sometimes there are economic concerns. You don't have a job. Or there might be childcare difficulties or there might be health concerns. And I've had really good luck and also a lot of privilege of a certain kind that makes it easier for me to stay employed. So work is one kind of a grind. For some folks, merely existing is another kind of grind. I've had it easy. There are different kinds of grindingness that you can learn from. There is the day-to-day grindingness of oppression. But for me, I've learned a lot from the grindingness of work. You just keep doing it. You don't always expect things to be good. That's why they call it work. You don't get too darn excited. And so I think that principle, which I absorbed over a number of years, that principle that you just keep doing it has served me well in connection with my Zen practice. You just keep showing up, whether it feels good, whether it doesn't. You do the sitting. You don't get too excited about how it's going. So sometimes the Four Noble Truths can seem pretty mundane. It seems like we always want it to be better or to be different. and not to be mundane. But, you know, we're just going to have to knock it off. We have to do the work. And retreats help with this. A 7-day retreat kind of wears you down at some point. And that's the idea. Finally, you just do the work and you drop the drama. So grinding away, I don't mean to sound grim. I love the work. Sometimes the work gets hard. I try to not make it harder by trying to make it be what it's not. And that's the practice. And just one more thing I'd like to mention is something else that we can do that really helps, and that's self-care. That's really not part of the Four Noble Truths, not directly at least. There's no step on the Eightfold Path for relaxing and taking a nap and good nutrition and getting exercise. But self-care is more about the middle way. And the middle way is tied in ultimately to the Four Noble Truths. Because it was only when the Buddha found the middle way that he was able to formulate this teaching of the Four Noble Truths. I talked about this in my class, about how Siddhartha had subjected himself to all kinds of deprivations, including almost starving himself to death, almost as if he wanted to kill off his body in order to free his mind. And he was sitting in a graveyard one evening, and a cool breeze came to him, and he remembered how, as a child, he had experienced this feeling of bliss unbidden while sitting under a rose apple tree. And he realized that you don't have to deprive yourself so much in order to be enlightened. And he took solid food again, and he looked after himself. And it was then that he was ready to sit down under a tree and push through to complete enlightenment. So the middle way, it's crucial to the practice of the Four Noble Truths. We won't have the energy to examine our suffering and its sources, and we won't have the energy to do something about it if we don't take care of ourselves. So I said earlier that I learned this approach to work, which is that everything is subservient to the full-time card. And that can work, and sometimes it has to. Sometimes we don't have a choice because we need the money. The kids have to eat. We don't have time to take care of ourselves. And we have 3 part-time jobs. But still, if we can find some time, if we can possibly do it, if we can possibly look after ourselves by maybe getting new nutrition or getting good nutrition, getting exercise, getting enough rest, maybe meditating or whatever, it's going to pay off. If you can put in the time up front to stay healthy, it will work for you. And I think we know this on some level sometimes, even when we kind of grind ourselves down to nothing. If you fail to look after yourself, you're failing all human beings. And I don't mean to, you know, shame anyone who's like working really hard by saying this. I just want you to take care of yourself because you're more effective that way and everyone's happier. So that's why during this month, even though I've been putting in really long hours, and I could have easily said, I don't have time to go to the gym anymore. I made the gym the number one priority because I love going there and working out. And I think that's one reason I've been able to get through all of this so well, that I make that the number one priority. I get that exercise no matter what. And that comes before the full time card. So this has been a talk about what to do when things get hard and what do you do. Keep at it and don't get too excited. And it's kind of funny, right? But that's my distillation of advice after this very exciting and wonderful time. Keep at it and don't get too excited. But we kind of exist on 2 levels. Even when things are very, very good, and this is important, even when things are very, very bad, we have a kind of day-to-day quietude and a kind of no big dealness that helps us to get through. And Zen practice is a lot about that. Being less governed by the vicissitudes of life. Steady on. Love the highs, get through the lows, and through it all, have comfort in that steadiness. And I remember saying to a Buddhist teen group at our first meeting years ago, that I want to share this practice with all of you because I want you to have a place to go. I want you to have a place to go in the sense that I want you to know that you can come to the center here and get support when you need it, but also that you have a place to go inside, that you know you can access that steadiness and persistence and that no big dealness, and know that it's always there and it's always available to you, whatever dramas you might have going on. And so that's my wish for everyone here as well. And that's what I have to say this morning.